station, Gable stuck his big Rottweiler head into several of the offices along the hallway, checking to see what other station case officers were doing. They were empty.
Good, said Gable. Everyone's ass out on the street. Fucking world as it should be.
Gable took Nate to lunch in a grubby little Turkish restaurant in a small snow-filled alley near the train station. The steamy single dining room had half a dozen tables, a pass-through window from the kitchen, and a framed portrait of Ataturk on the wall. People were yelling in the kitchen, but when Gable went to the window and clapped his hands, the noise stopped. A thin, dark man with a black mustache and an apron parted the bead curtain and came out of the kitchen. He embraced Gable briefly and was introduced as Tariq, the owner. The Turk shook hands loosely without looking into Nate's eyes. They took a corner table and Gable pulled out the chair he wanted Nate to sit in, against the wall with a view of the door. Gable sat with his back to the other wall. Speaking Turkish, Gable ordered 2 Adana kebabs, 2 beers, bread, and salad.
"Hope you like it spicy," said Gable. "This little shithole has the best Turkish food in the city. There are a lot of immigrants from Turkey around here."
Gable looked at the kitchen. He leaned forward.
"I popped Tariq about a year ago. Support asset, you know. Pick up mail, pay rent on a safe house, keep his ear to the ground. Couple hundred a month and he's happy. If we need to, we can tap into the expat community in Helsinki."
Gable straightened as the food came, 2 long flat kebabs speckled with red pepper, grilled a dark brown. A large broiled flatbread splashed with melted butter was underneath. Raw onion salad sprinkled with dark red sumac and lemon was piled on the side of the plate. 2 sweating bottles of beer were plunked on the table as Tariq muttered, "May it be good for you," and withdrew. Gable began eating before Nate picked up his fork. He wolfed food, talking and moving his big mitts in the air.
"It's not bad, huh?" he asked of the kebabs, his mouth full.
He upended his beer and drank half the bottle, his jaws snatched at the food, gazelle going down the gullet of a crocodile. Without preamble or embarrassment, he asked Nate what the fuck had happened in Moscow between him and that asshole Gondorf. Mortified, his worries rekindled, Nate explained briefly a few sentences. Gable pointed at him with his fork.
"Listen up. Remember 2 things about this fucking business. You can never mature as an operator unless you failed large at least once. And you're judged by your accomplishments, the results you bring, and how you protect your agents. Nothing else matters."
The other half of the bottle disappeared, and Gable called for another.
"Oh, there's another thing," he said. "Gondorf's a douchebag. Don't worry about him."
Gable was finished with his entire plate before Nate had even gotten through half of his. "Did you ever fail in your career?" he asked Gable.
"Are you kidding?" said Gable, tilting back his chair. "I was in the shit so often I rented the top floor of the latrine. That's how I got here. After the most recent train wreck, Forsythe saved my ass."
Gable's career had been spent primarily on this shithole tour, third world countries in Africa and Asia. Some case officers make their bones in the restaurants and hotel rooms and sidewalk cafes of Paris. Gable's world was one of midnight meetings on deserted dirt roads in red dust-covered Land Rovers. Other officers tape-recorded their meetings with government ministers. Gable wrote secrets into a sweat-damp notebook while sitting with agents sour with fear, making them concentrate, making them stay fucking on topic. They would sit in the heat, engine block ticking, with the windows up, watching the heads of the mambas part the tops of the tall grass on either side of the vehicle. Nate had heard that Gable was a legend. He was loyal to his assets, then to his friends, then to the CIA, in that order. There was nothing he hadn't seen, and he knew what was important. Gable sat back and sipped his beer, started talking. "Last assignment was in Istanbul. Big fucking town, good ops, Dodge City. Spoke pretty good Turkish, knew where to go, who to see. Pretty fast he'd recruited a member of the PKK, the benighted Kurdish separatist terror group from eastern Turkey. They'd been leaving bombs in briefcases in government buildings or shoeshine kits in the bazaar or paper sacks and trash cans in Taksim Square. One day Gable got into a taxi driven by a Kurd kid,
20, 21 years old. Sounded sharp, drove okay. Listen up. You gotta keep your eyes open all the time. He had a hunch, an instinct, so he told the kid to stop at a restaurant, invited him to eat with him, this Kurd kid. He had to stare down the fat Turk motherfucker behind the counter. They all hated Kurds, called them Mountain Turks. Kid ate like he was hungry, talked about his family. Gable smelled PKK. So he hired the taxi for a week of driving around. Hunch paid off. Kid was a member of the local cell, but didn't buy the terrorism bullshit. A little respect, 500 euros a month, a nice little recruitment. All because Gable kept his eyes fucking open in a taxi. Don't forget that. The kid started with useless shit, but Gable straightened him out. Called agent handling for a fucking reason. And they focused on cell leaders, how they got their orders, how the couriers traveled. Not bad, but Gable pushed the kid and they started getting the locations of PKK warehouses where they stored the Semtex or whatever they were using. Nitrolit from Poland. Then he started passing the names of the bomb makers. It was getting good and we had to keep a cold compress on the Turkish National Police because they wanted to wrap them up. Capture them dead, they used to say. COS in Ankara was happy and the suits in headquarters were bobbing their heads. Then Gable got cocky, lost the bubble. Lesson for Nate, you always have to keep the bubble. Young Kurd lived in Tepebasi, Fundo neighborhood down the hill from Pera, the old European quarter. Gable normally met the kid in his taxi, driving around town, never stopping, nighttime always on the fly. Broke the rules and visited the kid's house to meet the family. At his house. The kid had invited him. It would have been an insult to refuse. Got to be culturally sensitive, goddammit. Besides, Gable wanted to see where his agent lived. Listen up, you always know where your agents live. You never know whether you're going to have to dig them out of the woodwork some night. The street was steep, lined with peeling wooden row houses, faded splendor, narrow front steps, double front doors, etched glass side lights, all broken and boarded. Former European neighborhood now littered with garbage and smelling of drains. In Istanbul, you get used to smelling sewage, actually smells sort of sweet. Anyway, it was getting dark and lights in the houses were starting to come on. Evening call to prayer had just ended. Gable had come down the hill dreading it. This was going to be an awkward hour full of shy, downcast eyes and endless glasses of tea. Fuck it. Part of the job. As he approached the house, he heard screams. His agent's front door was open. Something breaking. Fuck, not good. Neighbors would be gathering soon. Gable thought it would be a circus in approximately 2 minutes. He started drifting away from the house, pretty dark by now. No one would notice him. Trouble was, at the front door, two guys were marching Gable's agent out of the house by the armpits. The kid's wife was slight and dark, with almond eyes from the south slopes of the Taurus Mountains, torn t-shirt, barefoot. She was right behind them, screaming, beating at the men. A baby about 2 years old stood in the doorway, buck naked, crying. These two dickheads were as skinny as Gable's agent, but there was no resistance, maybe because one of the dickheads held a pistol. Jesus Christ, the kid's in trouble with the PKK. Maybe he spent the extra money, maybe he bragged about his new foreign friend. Listen up, it goes south fast. You gotta protect them. Sometimes you gotta do it for them. The PKK took a medieval view when dealing with countrymen they thought were traitors. Gable could have walked away. Saw the baby girl in the door, cute little thing, bubble butt and slobbering nose, and he thought, nah, fuck it. Stepped up to the first step of the house and smiled at the dickheads. They stopped and let go of the kid, who fell on his ass on the top step. Little wife stopped screaming and looked at Gable. Big fucking Yabanshi foreigner with big knuckles. A dozen neighbors edging around, all Kurds. Fucking neighborhood was dead quiet, not a sound. Water running down the center of the street. The dickhead with the pistol yelled something in Kurdish, sounded like sash weights in a washtub. Big Mouth began waving the pistol, pointing it at the kid, at the wife, shaking it like a finger. Kid was 100% dead if Gable didn't do something. Fuck it anyway, because this was abso-fucking-lutely end of the case. The kid would have to skip Turkey if he wanted to stay alive. PKK guy came down a step and continued yelling at Gable, ignored the beady eyes focused on the pistol. Little fuck's knuckles whiten on the grip. You know you got about 3 seconds. Barrel started coming up. Gable was carrying a high power and a Bianchi belt loop behind his hip. He cleared the Browning and shot the Kurd, pop, pop, pop. Call it the Mozambique, double tap center mass, third round forehead. Suppose it was invented over there or something. Dickhead's eyes opened, fell straight down in a heap. Slid skull first down the stairs. Pistol bounced after him. Gable picked it up, threw it, clattered down a sewer grate. Gotta be a million guns in Istanbul's sewers. Gable's spent brass hadn't hit the pavement before the neighbors bolted like fucking squirrels, going in all directions, shutters slamming up and down the hill. The Kurd kid held his wife. Wondered if the kid realized their new life started right then. Maybe, the wife probably did. Looked smart, nipples showing through that t-shirt. Gable looked at the other PKK guy, who's seen Jesus or Muhammad, whatever, and the guy held his hands in front of him, palms out, walked down the steps, and ran down the street into the dark. Gable gave the kid $5,000 to clear out. Couldn't get any more out of headquarters. Don't know where they went. Maybe they're in Germany or France. 5 Kurdish kids learning German. When they turn 20, Nate's son can find and recruit them. Fucking crazy. Okay, now the point of this long fucking story. Aftermath was a veritable shitstorm, I kid you not, Gable said. First it was the consulate and the hysterical consul general, tinny voice like a music box. Then the embassy in Ankara. Then the knife and fork set at the State Department. Diplomat involved in fatal shooting. They were very upset. A lot of weeping. Grave repercussions. Had to leave Istanbul. The Turkish National Police gave me a plaque and a farewell dinner. They were delighted. Turkish cops love a good shootout. But everyone else was seriously pissed. An official CIA investigation hadn't even started. Gable waltzed around with Office of Security at headquarters for a month. After 40 hours of conversation, they settled on deficient tradecraft. COS Ankara didn't back Gable up. Too much political heat. Sounds like Gondorf, doesn't it? Plenty of assholes to go in your career. Gable's prospects for foreign operations were over for the indefinite future, it seemed, and he was stuck in a 4x4 cubicle on the Turkish desk in headquarters, listening to a 23-year-old new hire on the other side of the partition, talking on the outside line to her girlfriend about getting up the nerve to fillet her boyfriend that weekend. None of the young officers even wore wristwatches, goddammit. They told time with their fucking phones, or tablets, or whatever they're called. Gable didn't feel sorry for himself. It was operations. All this happened to him, but for the right reason. Listen up. The most important thing is your agent, his security. Saving his life, it's the only thing. At about the same time, Forsyth had just concluded his own personal shitstorm, but had bounced back and landed in Helsinki. He heard Gable was fucked, that was nothing new, and sent for him as his number two, like the old days. Only there aren't any good old days, it's a myth. The ecstatics at headquarters were happy to let Gable go to Finland as DCOS. No one else wanted the job and they wanted him off the desk. Bad influence. So, here we are, 3 fuck-ups in the field operating near the frickin' Arctic Circle. You and me drinking beer in a Turkish hash house. Gable finished his beer and yelled, "Hey, sup!" When Tariq came out of the kitchen, Gable motioned to Nate. "He's paying." Nate laughed. "Wait a minute," said Nate. "What do you mean Forsyth went through his own shitstorm? What happened to him?" Nate dug out a few euros and handed them to Tariq. "Keep the change." Tariq smiled thinly, nodded to Gable, and retreated to the kitchen. "You over-tipped, rookie," said Gable. "Don't let them get used to you paying out. Gotta keep them hungry." Gable got up and shrugged on his coat. "Bullshit," said Nate. "You paid that young Kurd $5,000 to get him out of Dodge, but even you admitted he was burned, useless. You didn't have to pay him squat." Nate looked at Gable as they turned out of the alley and walked in front of the train station. Gable avoided looking back at him, and Nate knew that Gable was more than just a tough guy. But he wasn't going to test the limits anytime soon. The air was cold, and Nate flipped up the collar of his overcoat. "You didn't answer me about Forsythe," said Nate. "What's the story?" Gable ignored the question and continued walking down the sidewalk. "Do you know where the Russian embassy is?" asked Gable. "China, Iran, Syria. You should be able to get in a car and drive directly to any one of them. You might have to exfil some poor bastard someday. I'll give you a week to find them all." "Yeah, okay, no problem. But what about Forsythe? What happened?" Nate had to keep dodging around pedestrians on the snowy sidewalk as Gable bulled his way through the afternoon crowds. They got to a corner and waited to cross. Nate saw a coffee shop on the opposite side of the street. "Quick cup of coffee? Come on, I'll buy." Gable looked at Nate sideways and nodded. Over coffee and a short brandy, Gable told the story. Forsythe was considered one of the shit-hot chiefs of station in the service. Throughout his 25-year career, Forsythe came up the ranks with a brilliant record. As a young officer, he recruited the first ever North Korean reporting asset. Before the wall came down, he directed a Polish colonel who brought Forsythe the complete war plans for Warsaw Pact Southern Command. A few years later, he recruited the Georgian defense minister who, in exchange for a Swiss bank account, arranged for a T-80 tank with the new reactive armor to be driven at 0300 across the shale beach at Batumi and up the ramp of a heavy landing craft leased by the CIA from the Romanians. As he moved up, Forsythe was one of the senior managers who had done the work and knew what the game was about. Case officers loved him. Ambassadors came to him for advice. Seventh-floor suits at headquarters trusted him, and at age 47 he was rewarded with the plum COS Rome job. Forsythe's first year in Rome was, as expected, a solid success. What no one expected was that politically savvy Tom Forsythe would tell the supercilious staff aide of a senator visiting Rome on a congressional delegation to shut up and listen instead of talking during a station briefing. She had questioned the condign wisdom of a controversial and compartmented Rome station operation. The 23-year-old political science major from Yale with 20 months of experience on the Hill had moreover personally criticized Forsythe's management of the case by saying she thought the tradecraft employed was, in a word, subpar. This elicited from the usually phlegmatic Forsythe a cryptic, "Go fuck yourself," which days later resulted in the headquarters notification that the senator had complained that Forsythe's Rome assignment was curtailed, that he was being relieved for cause. After the usual righteous letter of reprimand in Forsythe's file, the seventh floor quietly offered Forsythe the COS Helsinki job. The offer was made to demonstrate to Congress that headquarters sympathized with Forsythe's reaction to fatuous oversight inflicted on hard-working field operators during Codel shopping junkets camouflaged as fact-finding trips. Offering Forsythe Helsinki was, in addition, an insincere and calculated offer because no one thought Forsythe would accept. The station was one-sixth the size of Rome's, and arguably the least important of four somewhat sleepy Scandinavian countries, a post for a junior COS. They expected Forsythe to decline, find a place to park himself, and leave in 2 years when he became eligible to retire. "By accepting the assignment, he basically told the seventh floor to go fuck themselves," said Gable. "A half year later, he got me as his deputy, and yesterday you arrive." "Not that you're a fuck-up," Gable laughed. "You're just known as one." Gable saw Nate's face, the faraway stare. "Okay," he told himself, "this kid has a worm in his guts." He'd seen it before, the talented case officer too fucking afeared for his rep and future to be able to relax and let it flow. That way-faced Gondorf had rattled the kid. Should be ashamed of himself, and now he and Forsythe had to get Nash thinking straight. He made a mental note to talk to the COS. The last thing Station needed was a CO who didn't know the right time to pull the recruitment trigger. Tariq's Adana Kebab. Puree red bell and hot peppers with salt and olive oil.
add puree to ground lamb, chopped onion, garlic and parsley, finely cubed butter, coriander, cumin, paprika, olive oil, salt, and pepper. Knead and shape into flat kebabs. Grill until almost charred. Serve with grilled pita bread and thinly sliced purple onions sprinkled with lemon and sumac. Chapter 8. The white and blue Voskhod hydrofoil settled into the water and approached the dock in a trailing cloud of blue diesel smoke. Carrying a small suitcase, Dominika stepped onto the steep pontoon ramp on the edge of the tarry mudflats and walked up to a bus waiting on the gravel road above the river. 11 young people, 7 women and 4 men, trudged up the pier behind her. They were all silent and tired and put their bags down in front of the open baggage compartment of the bus. No one spoke. They didn't glance at one another. Dominika turned and looked out over the wide Volga River, pine trees lining both sides down to the shoreline. The air was humid, and the river smelled of diesel fuel. 3 kilometers north, around a bend in the river, the steeples and minarets around the Kazan Kremlin could just be seen in the morning haze. Dominika knew it was Kazan because they had driven through the city from the airfield, past all the highway signs. That meant they were in Tatarstan, still in European Russia. At midnight, they had flown 700 kilometers from Moscow to a darkened military airfield. Unlit signs had read Boryshklebskoye Aerodrome and Kazan State Aircraft Plant. They had silently boarded a bus, the star-cracked windows covered by stained gray curtains. They drove through quiet pre-dawn streets to a waterfront pier where they boarded the wallowing hydrofoil as the sun was coming up over the city. They waited wordlessly for an hour in the aircraft-style seats of the hydrofoil and stifling air. The arrhythmic rocking of the hull, the slopping water against the pier, and the creaking of the frayed nylon line straining against the bollards made her queasy, then sleepy. Apart from the driver of the bus and a man on the bridge of the vessel, they had seen no one. Dominika watched the sunlight spread on the water and counted the seabirds. Eventually, a gray Lada pulled up to a gangplank and a man and woman got out, carrying 2 flat cardboard boxes. They boarded the boat, placed the boxes on the counter at the front of the cabin, and opened the flaps. "Come and help yourselves," said the woman, and sat down in a front-row seat with her back to the passengers. They rose slowly and made their way to the front. They had not eaten since breakfast the day before. One box was full of fresh-baked boloshki, sweet buns with raisins, the other filled with waxed containers of warm orangeade. The man watched the passengers return to their seats, then went out and spoke to the man on the bridge. The vessel's engine started with a rumble, and a shudder went through the seats. The aluminum gangway banged onto the pier, and the lines were cast off. The hydrofoil was on plane, up on its foils, and the whole ship trembled as it sped downriver. The seat in front of her vibrated, the cabin headliner grommets buzzed, the metal ashtray inserts chattered in the armrests. Fighting down nausea, Dominika focused on the fabric of the grimy headrest in front of her. Courtesan College. She was flying down the Volga toward the colossal indignity. Now they were on the bus, the nameless woman sitting in the front seat. They swayed through the sun-dappled pine forest, finally stopping at a concrete slab wall. The sun caught the broken glass mortared along the top. The bus sounded its horn, then squeezed through the gate and up a sweeping drive and stopped in front of a 2-story neoclassical mansion with a mansard roof of spalling slate. It was absolutely quiet in the woods, without a breath of a breeze, and there was no movement from within the mansion. Deep breath. Come on, snap out of it. This disgusting school was another obstacle, more sacrifice, another test of her loyalty. She stood in the piney woods in front of the mustard-colored mansion and waited. She had arrived at Sparrow School. After talking with her uncle, Dominika had thought hard about telling them all to go to hell. She contemplated taking her mother back to Strelna on the shores of the Nevskaya Guba near Petersburg. She could find work as a teacher or a gym coach. With luck and time, she might find employment at the Vaganova Academy, back into ballet. But no, she decided she was not going to run away. She would do this, whatever it took. They were not going to shoot her. This was about physical love. It would not matter what they made her do. They could not defeat her spirit. And even as she revolted against the thought, Dominika's secret self, the humming servo of her body, wondered whether the grimy catechism's resident in the ochre building before her would in any small way fulfill her. She hated the thought of Sparrow's school and was abashed at having been sent here, but she privately was expectant, watchful. "Leave your bags in the hallway and follow me," said the woman, who had preceded them up the front steps and through the towering front doors of weathered wood. They gathered in an auditorium. Judging by the bookshelves, it had formerly been a library that had been converted into a lecture hall, with a raised wooden platform and dais and several rows of creaking wooden seats at one end of the room. The woman, dressed in a shapeless black suit, walked among them and passed out envelopes by hand. "Inside you will find your room assignments," she said, "and the names you will use during your training. Use only these names. You will not relate any personal information about yourselves to other students. Any infraction will result in immediate dismissal." In her early 50s, the administrator had upswept gray hair, a square face, and a straight nose. She looked like the woman on the stamps, Tereshkova, the first woman in space. Her words came out in gouts of yellow. "You have been chosen for specialized training," said the matron. "It is a great honor. The nature of the training may seem alien and strange to some of you. Concentrate on the lessons and the exercises. Nothing else is important." Her voice echoed in the high-ceilinged hall. "Now go upstairs and find your rooms. Dinner is at 6 in the dining room across the hall. Instruction will begin here this evening at 7 o'clock. Go now. Dismiss." In the upper hallway, Dominika counted 12 rooms, 6 either side, numbers in cracked enamel lozenges screwed into the wood. Between the bedroom doors along the hallway were other plain doors without knobs or handles. These could be opened only by use of a key. Her room was painted light green and was spare but comfortable, with a single bed, standing closet, table, and chair. There was a faint but constant odor of disinfectant on the bedspread, in the closet, in the stack of sheets on the shelf. The room had a curtained-off toilet, above which hung a hand shower and a rust-stained sink. Above the writing table was a large mirror, too large, incongruous with the barrack-style room. Dominika put her cheek flat against the mirror and looked at the surface in glancing light, like in training. The silver smokiness of a two-way mirror. Welcome to Sparrow School. Dusk and the night sky not visible through the pine tops. The house was dimly lit. There were no clocks in the mansion anywhere. No telephone rang. The hallways and staircases and ground floor rooms were silent. The night invaded the house. The walls were bare, held none of the daguerreotype official portraits of Lenin or Marx, though moldy outlines where portraits once hung were still visible on the panels. What Tatar noble family had lived here before the revolution? Did resplendent parties ride and hunt in these pines? Did they hear the whistle of the Moscow steam packet from the river? What Soviet instinct had put the school this far away from Moscow? She looked around the dining table at the 11 other students silently spooning tokmach, a thick noodle soup that had been ladled into their bowls from a colossal blue and white porcelain tureen by a wordless waiter. A plate of boiled meat followed. The women and 3 of the men were all in their 20s. The 4th man seemed even younger, in his teens, thin and pale. Were any of them also SVR trained? Dominika turned to the woman on her left and smiled. "My name is Katya," she said, using her training alias. The woman smiled back. "I am Anya." She was slight and blonde, with a wide mouth and high cheekbones lightly dusted by freckles. She looked like an elegant milkmaid with pale blue eyes. Her halting words were cornflower blue, innocence and artlessness. Others shyly recited their aliases. After dinner, they filed quietly into the library. It was absolutely quiet in the room, then the lights dimmed. Welcome to Sparrow School Instruction. A film started, stark black and white images, brutal, feral, sawtoothed. It burst onto a screen at the front of the room, with straining faces, clasping bodies, organs, shafting endlessly, everywhere, now in such close focus to become gynecological, unrecognizable, unworldly. The sound started at full volume, and Dominica saw the heads of her classmates jerk back at this sudden assault of sound and sight. The air was filled with spinning color for her. She knew the signs of overload when the bleeding sequence red, violet, blue, green, yellow began. She had no control and closed her eyes to escape the onslaught. Then a speaker popped and the sound suddenly went down to barely audible, so that the woman on the screen seemed as if she were whispering, even as her hair stuck to the side of her face and her body was jolted endlessly by an off-screen partner. The light flickered on the ceiling beams 20 feet above her head. Could she last here for the duration? What would they expect her to do? What would they do if she got up and walked out of the room? Would she be dismissed from the service? The hell with them. They wanted a sparrow, they would get a sparrow. No one knew she could see the colors. Mikhail had said she was the best student he ever had in seeing people. She would stay. She would learn. She told herself this wasn't love. This school, this mansion secluded behind walls, topped with broken glass, was an engine of the state that institutionalized and dehumanized love. It didn't count. It was physical sex. It was training, like ballet school. In the flickering light in the musty library, Dominica told herself she was going to go through with this, despite these bastards. The lights came on and the students sat red-faced and embarrassed. Anya sniffled and wiped her eyes with the back of her fist. The matron addressed the students in a flat, hard voice. "You have had a long journey. Return to your rooms and get some rest. Instruction resumes tomorrow morning at 0700. Dismiss." Nothing in her manner would have even remotely indicated that they had been watching a film of people engaged in coitus for the last 90 minutes. They filed out and up the grand staircase with the massive wooden banisters. Anya nodded goodnight before closing her door. Dominica wondered whether Anya or the others knew that tonight the as-yet-unseen staff of the Cullen Institute, stuffed into the cabinet de voyeur between rooms, would be watching them undressing, bathing, and sleeping. Dominica stood in front of the mirror, ran the long-handled brush through her hair, the only familiar token she had brought from home, and she looked at it in her hand, as if it could mock her. She stood and unbuttoned her blouse. She slipped the blouse on a bent wire hanger and nonchalantly hooked it on the frame of the mirror, covering one end of it. She set her little suitcase on the table and opened the lid against the mirror, blocking a further third. She stepped out of her skirt and pirouetted unconsciously to look at the curve of her back and the swell of her bottom and the nylon panties before casually flipping the skirt over the frame of the mirror, covering the last third. They would clear the mirror in the morning, perhaps speak sharply to her about it, but it was worth it tonight. Then she brushed her teeth, got under sheets in a disinfectant bloom of camphor and rose oil, and flipped off the light. She left the hairbrush on the dresser. The men were separated from the women, and the days spilled into one another, and they lost a sense of time. Soporific mornings were devoted to endless lectures on anatomy, physiology, and psychology of the human sexual response. A few new staff appeared. A female doctor droned endlessly about sexual practices in different cultures. Then came the classes on male anatomy, knowing how a man's body works, how to excite a male. The techniques, positions, movements numbered in the hundreds. They were studied, repeated, memorized, an upper Volga Kama Sutra. Dominica marveled at this monstrous encyclopedia, at the sticky epiphanies that ruined normality, that forever would rob Dominica of her innocence. Could she ever make love again? Afternoons were reserved for practical subjects, as if they were training to be ice skaters. They practiced walking, they practiced conversation, they practiced pulling the cork out of a champagne bottle. There were rooms of used clothes, scuffed shoes, sweat-stained lingerie. They dressed up and practiced talking to one another, learned to listen, to show interest, to make compliments and to flatter, and most important, to elicit information during conversation. A rare afternoon of camaraderie, five of them sitting on the floor of the library in a circle, knees almost touching, laughing, chattering, practicing what they called sex talk from what they had heard in the nightly films. "It's like this," said a dark-haired girl with the heavy accent of the Black Sea, and she closed her eyes and murmured in cast-iron English, "Ya, lovers, you are making me to come." Gales of laughter and Dominica looked at the blushing faces and wondered how soon some of them would find themselves in their underwear in the in-tourist hotel in Volgograd watching skinny Vietnamese trade reps shuck off their shoes. "Katia, you try," said the girl to Dominica. From the first night, they had all sensed she was somehow different, somehow special. Beside her, Anya looked at her expectantly. Without knowing why, perhaps to show them, perhaps to show herself, Dominica closed her eyes and whispered, "Yes, honey, just like that, oh, God." And pushing the sound up from her belly, "Ugh!" Shocked silence, and then the circle of girls roared their approval and applauded. Anya stared, flaxen-haired and wide-eyed and wordless, mindless of the general hilarity of the moment. Anya of the meadow flower blue halo. She was struggling, aghast at the most salacious aspects of training, and clung to Dominica for courage and support. "You have to get used to it," Dominica told her. But Anya cringed during the nightly films, holding Dominica's hand tightly as the fuck circus raged on the screen in front of them. "The little farm girl isn't going to make it," Dominica thought. "Her color is getting weaker, not stronger." Then one night, after an impossibly depraved film that had her silently weeping, Anya came to Dominica's room, eyes red and lips trembling, her cornflower syllables barely visible. She had come to her friend for solace. She was losing her mind. She had told them she was quitting, but they had said something to her, God only knew what, and she could not leave. Dominica pulled her by the hand behind the bathroom curtain. "You have to get through this," she whispered, shaking Anya gently by the shoulders. Anya sobbed and threw her arms around Dominica's neck. She pressed her lips against Dominica's mouth. The little idiot was trembling, and Dominica did not pull away, did not reject her. They were on the floor of the little bathroom. Dominica cradled Anya in her arms, felt her shake. Anya turned her head up for another kiss, and Dominica almost refused, but then relented and kissed her again. The kiss had an effect on Anya, and she reached for Dominica's hand, pulled it to her body, and slid it beneath her bathrobe onto her breast. "Oh, for God's sake," thought Dominica. She herself felt no passion, but rather sadness for the girl in her arms. Was this the bisexuality they had lectured to them about downstairs? Could they be observed behind the curtain? Was there audio in the room? Was this a serious offense? Anya held her hand by the wrist and trailed it over her nipple, which swelled under Dominica's fingertips. The bathrobe fell open and Anya pulled the captured hand lower, between her legs. Perversion? An act of kindness? Something else? Dominica's unknown ancestral libertine, whoever she was, kept her going, an inexplicable out-of-body state where stopping now was only slightly less possible than going ahead. Dominica's feather-light fingertips traced minute, perfect circles, and Anya melted, her head turned into Dominica, the line of her neck soft and vulnerable. Sitting up against the bathroom tiles, Dominica felt Anya's breath between her own legs, and there was no reason now to stop. Her secret self told her to feel her body, and the sensation of Anya's breathy exhalations radiated up her stomach. Dominika's head dropped back against the tile, and her arm gripped the side of the sink for support. She felt Prabhabushka's tortoiseshell brush in her hand and pulled it down. Her great-grandmother's hairbrush, her mother had brushed her own hair with it. It was her secret companion during the thunderstorms of her girlhood. Dominika trailed the handle down Anya's stomach, making the soft amber curve infinitely light, infinitely insistent. Anya held her breath and her eyes fluttered behind tight-shut eyes. Looking at Anya's face, Dominika positioned the handle and flexed her wrist. Anya's mouth opened partway, and her eyes showed a sliver of white, like the slack face of a corpse on a slab. Anya stiffened and began shaking against the slow plunge and drag of tortoiseshell. She turned, chin wet, to look up at Dominika and whispered, "Yes, baby, just so. You're coming me." And Dominika smiled and watched the little milkmaid thrash about while she put her own secret self back in the hurricane room inside her and closed the door. After a few minutes, Anya sighed and turned her face up to be kissed again. "Enough. You have to go, quickly now," Dominika said. Red-faced, Anya gathered her bathrobe around her, looked at Dominika, and went silently out. Would there be bellowed accusations tomorrow morning? Was there anyone behind the mirror right now? Too tired to care, Dominika got into bed in the darkened room. The brush lay forgotten on the floor under the sink. The next morning, in a large downstairs salon, wood-paneled and carpeted with a huge blue and ivory Kazakh carpet, the women were ordered to sit in chairs set in a circle in the center of the room. The first student, a slight young brunette with the lilting Western accent of Novgorod, was ordered to stand up, undress, and walk around the circle to be critiqued by the others. There was shocked silence. She hesitated, but then disrobed. The female doctor and her assistant, both in lab coats, acted as moderators, noting strengths and weaknesses. Finished, the student was ordered to sit in her chair, but to remain naked. The next student was called, and the process was repeated. Flushed faces, goosebumps, and bitten lips, the room slowly was filled with incongruous, shivering, naked bodies, a pitiful pile of clothes and shoes beneath each chair. Thank God there were no men present. Anya twisted her hands nervously as her turn inexorably came, and she looked over to Dominika in a panic. Dominika looked away. The doctor snapped at Anya to hurry up when she hesitated to peel off her panties. Now it was her turn, and Dominika ignored her nervousness and stood up when she was called. It was monstrous to be ordered to strip off in the presence of half a dozen strangers, but she forced herself. Anya looked at her intently. Dominika was embarrassed as much by her nudity as by the awed silence in the room when she walked around the circle of chairs. "Best in breed," whispered the assistant. "Best in show," corrected the doctor. The following day, a man stood in the circle of chairs and took off a short bathrobe. He was naked underneath and needed to bathe and clean his toenails. The doctor evaluated the pale body for the students, and close-up assessment followed. The next day, the man in the bathrobe was back, this time with a short, stocky woman with iodine red hair and chapped cheeks and elbows. They disrobed and unconcernedly made love on a mattress in the center of the student's circle of chairs. The doctor pointed out different lovemaking positions. She would order the couple to stop in mid-act to illustrate a relevant point or to demonstrate a physical refinement. The models showed no emotion, neither for themselves nor for their partners, their colors so washed out as to be invisible. It was soulless. "I cannot look at them," Anya confessed to Dominika. They had grown into the habit of walking together around the shabby garden of the mansion in the few free minutes after breakfast. "I cannot do this. I simply cannot." "Listen, you can become used to anything," said Dominika. How was this girl ever selected? From what provincial capital had she been picked?
Then she wondered to herself, what about you? Can you become accustomed to anything after enough time? The next week was, as Dominica anticipated, a multiplication of indignity. Again, the salon and the familiar circle of chairs, but this time men, brusque men in tight suits and bad haircuts, sat in the circle. The female students were told to undress in front of these men, who then proceeded to critique each of the students, pointing out flaws in her figure or complexion or face. They were never identified. Their yeasty yellow bubbles combined to tarnish the atmosphere of the entire room. Anya covered her tear-streaked face with her hands until the doctor told her to stop being a silly cow and to take her hands away this instant. Feeling as if she were in a dream, Dominica left her body, closed her mind, and endured the stares of a man with a terribly pocked face. The color coming from inside him made his eyes yellow, like a civet in an alley. She stared back at him without blinking as his eyes wandered over her. "Not enough meat on her," he said aloud to nobody in particular. "And her nipples are too small." Two other men nodded in agreement. Dominica stared them all down until they looked away or got busy lighting their cigarettes. Dominica was surprised to note that she was beginning to go numb. Numb to nakedness, numb to lewd commentary, numb to strangers' eyes looking at her breasts or her sex or her buttocks. "They can do what they like," she told herself, "but I won't let them look me in the eyes." Other students reacted in their own ways. One silly little idiot from Smolensk with the lilt of a southern Russian dialect vamped and hip-shot her way through the sessions. Anya never seemed to get over her shame. The defining smell of disinfectant in the mansion now was overlaid with the pungency of their bodies, musk and sweat and rose water and brown soap. And after lights out, the sweating staff sat in the cabinet and took notes and made sure the cameras were not blocked. Anya knocked softly at her door late one night, and Dominica opened it a crack and told her to go away. "I can't help you anymore," she said, and Anya turned and disappeared down the darkened hallway. "It isn't my problem," thought Dominica. "It's enough that I'm fighting for my own sanity." Then the bus came with the military cadets, the ones who had scored at the top of their class. The women waited for them in their rooms and sat on the beds and watched the skinny, bruised bodies as the boys ripped off their tunic shirts and boots and trousers and held on tight as they rutted like stoats until time was up. The cadets left without looking back at the women, and the bus swayed as it went through the gate into the pine forest. The next morning, in the curtained, darkened library, the projector began. But instead of the usual film, they saw their classmate in room number 5 on the single bed with a skinny, shaved-headed cadet from the day before. The women could barely look at the screen. This was shame. This was indignity, seeing yourself with legs hooked around a pimply back, hands formed into claws on bony shoulders. The doctor would freeze-frame the films to add commentary, suggest improvements. Worse, they all now guessed that the films would come in order, rooms 5, 6, 7, and so on. Anya's head was down, her face in her hands. She was in room 11 and would have to endure not only the films, but also the wait. She ran from the room weeping as her segment ended. The doctor let her flee. She prattled on about what had been done wrong, how it could be improved. Dominica was in room number 12 at the end of the hall. The filmed segment of the interlude with her cadet, therefore, was the last. Disembodied, she watched herself, surprised at her slack face, how mechanically she had grasped the young man and guided him, how she had pulled his ear to get him off when he collapsed on top of her. Her head was spinning, yet she felt no shame, no embarrassment. She looked at the images on the screen without feeling, and kept telling herself that she was a member of the Služba Vezhniye Razvedki, the Foreign Intelligence Service of the Russian Federation. The next morning, Anya did not come down to breakfast, and two girls found her in her room. They had to push the door open with their shoulders.
She had knotted pantyhose around her neck, wrapped the end around a coat hook on the back of the door, and simply had drawn her legs up and strangled herself. She had had the strength to keep her feet off the floor until she blacked out. The weight of her lolling body had kept the noose tight. In the garden, Dominica heard the screams. She raced upstairs, pushed the others aside, and lifted Anya off the hook and laid her on the floor. She felt guilt and anger. What did the little twit expect from her anyway? How could she have had the courage to choke to death, she thought, but not to lie with a man for 30 minutes? There barely was a reaction. The bear sniffed at the body, then turned its back. Anya was carried out of the mansion on a canvas stretcher, covered by a blanket, her blonde hair sticking out from under. Nothing was mentioned by anybody. The day's instruction continued as before. The course was coming to an end. The 6 sparrows watched as the 4 young men filed back into the dining room. They were fledgling ravens now, trained in a smaller villa down the road, 3 of them expert in the art of seducing the vulnerable and lonely women targeted by the SVR, the minister's spinster secretary, the ambassador's frustrated wife, the underappreciated female aide of a general. The 4th young man had learned another specialty, befriending the sensitive, fearful men, cipher clerks, military attachés, sometimes senior diplomats, who secretly yearned for male friendship, companionship, love, but who were heart-piercingly vulnerable to the threat of exposure. The ravens loftily declared that they had suffered during their training. Training partners were not readily available, whispered Dimitri. They practiced on unwashed girls from nearby villages, made love to sallow slatterns bussed from factories in Kazan. Dominica did not ask about the 4th boy, how and with whom he had practiced. But now we're trained to excel in love, said Dimitri. We are experts. He opened his arms and stared at them through his eyelashes. The women looked back at him wordlessly. Dominica saw the women's faces were closed down, saw the skepticism and fatalism and mistrust. These were like the vacant faces of the hookers on Tverskaya Ulitsa in Moscow. The fruits of Sparrow School, thought Dominica. Anya's empty place at the table was not the only cost. They departed for the airport at midnight, carrying their cheap cardboard suitcases, leaving the blacked-out mansion without a look back. Horse school was closed until the next group arrived. The pine woods were black, silent. The plane circled the smokestacks of Kazan and flew west over the invisible landscape. In another hour, they were over the lights of Nizhny Novgorod, bisected by the black ribbon of the Volga. Then came the gradual descent toward the glow of sleepless Moscow. She would never see any of the other trainees again. She was to report to the center the next morning to the 5th Department to start her career as a junior intelligence officer. She thought about Semyonov, chief of the 5th, and about the other officers she would meet, how they would look at her, what they would say. Well, she thought, the trained courtesan is back from the steppes, and she intended to inhabit their world. The living room was dark when she tiptoed into the apartment in the hours before dawn, but her mother appeared in the hallway, dressed in a bathrobe. "I heard your steps," she said, and Dominica knew she meant her uneven tread in the stairwell. Dominica hugged her, then took her mother's hand and kissed it, with lips that had been trained to ruin a man, an act of expiation. Sparrow School Tokmach Soup. Boil coarsely chopped potato, thinly sliced onions, and carrots in beef broth until soft. Add thin noodles and cook until done. Put boiled beef in bottom of bowl and pour broth and vegetables over. Chapter 9. Dominica reported to the 5th the next morning, still exhausted by the flight from Kazan. Walking down the long headquarters corridor with light green walls, She went to Semyonov's office to report for duty but was told the colonel was out and to come back later. Instead, they sent her to personnel, then to registry, then to records. She walked around a corner in the hallway and came upon Semyonov himself, talking to a white-haired man in a dark gray suit. She noticed the man's bushy white eyebrows and kindly smile. His liquid brown eyes narrowed as Semyonov made a brief introduction. General Korchnoi, chief of the Americas Department, Corporal Igorova. She vaguely knew the name, was aware of his seniority. Compared to the pale aura around Semyonov's head, Korchnoi was bathed in a flaming mantle of color, as bright as Dominika had seen in anyone. Purple velvet, deep and rich.
The corporal just returned from the course at Kazan, said Semyonov with a smirk. Everyone in the service knew what that meant. Dominika felt the blood rush to her cheeks. And she is assisting in the approach to the diplomat, the case I was telling you about, General.
More than just assist, said Dominika, looking at Semyonov, then at Korchnoi. I graduated from the forest in the last class. She ignored Sparrow School, cursing Semyonov under her breath. She knew what Semyonov was doing, but she sensed nothing from the older man, hard to read.
I heard about your record at the academy, Corporal, said the general enigmatically. I'm glad to meet you.
Korchnoi shook her hand with a dry, firm grasp. Semyonov looked on, smiling, thinking this would be the first of many senior officers who would try to dive down the front of her blouse. She'd be working in the front office of some general, and on his leather couch, within 6 months. Surprised and flattered, Dominika shook his hand, thanked the general, and continued down the corridor. The men's eyes followed her.
More steam than a banya in Yakutsk, whispered Semyonov when Dominika had walked around the corner. You know she's the niece of the deputy.
Korchnoi nodded.
Niece or not, she's going to be a pain in the ass, muttered Semyonov.
Korchnoi said nothing.
She wants to be an operator, but look at her, she's built to be a vorobeya. That's why Igorov sent her to Kazan.
And the Frenchman? Asked Korchnoi. Another snort.
Polovaya Zapadnya, a straight honey trap. A matter of weeks, he's a commercial type, we squeeze him dry and it's done.
He nodded his head down the hallway. She wants to read the file to get involved. The only thing she's going to get involved in is what's between the Frenchman's legs.
Korchnoi smiled.
Good luck, Colonel, he said, shaking hands.
Thank you, General, said Semyonov.
They had pointed her to a corner of the French section of the 5th Department. She had stared at the windowless angle of the walls as they met at the corner of the chipped desk, which was bare save for a cracked wooden in-tray. Two fat file folders were thrown rudely on her desk. Semyonov had finally released them to her to get her off his back. The dull blue covers with black diagonal stripes were dog-eared, spines fuzzy from sweaty hands. Osobaya Papka, her first operational file. She opened the cover and drank in the words, the colors. The target was Simon Delon, 48, first secretary in the commercial section of the Embassy of France in Moscow. Delon was married, but his wife remained in Paris. He traveled infrequently to France for conjugal visits. As a geographical bachelor in Moscow, Delon had been noticed by the FSB almost immediately. They assigned a single watcher at first, but as time passed and interest in him peaked, he was covered in FSB ticks. They spent a lot of time with their krolik, their rabbit. A 12-man team took him to work and put him to bed. Photos spilled out of an envelope stuck between the pages of the file. Delon walking along the river, alone watching the skaters at the dynamo rink, alone eating at a restaurant table. Dominika smoothed the creased blue surveillance flimsies. They had used a mirror to watch a long-legged hooker slide her hand up Delon's leg in a little escort bar. Subject, uncomfortable, nervous, refused, unable, to pick up hooker, read the entry. Poor devil, he didn't belong there, thought Dominika. Technical annex.
an audio implant and a living room electrical outlet produced hours of tape. 20:36:29, sounds of dish in sink. 22:12:34, music softly played.